The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
History tells the story of the world and of our lives. Sometimes that history goes bump in the night. Broadcasting from the Center of Oddity and the Supernatural in Central Florida, it's the History Goes Bump podcast.
Hello, you spooktacular people. Welcome to this 522nd episode of the History Goes Bump podcast, Ghost Tours for the Theater of the Mind. I'm your host, Diane.
And this is Kelly.
On this episode, we're covering a couple of locations. The first one was suggested by our listener, Ivy Johnson, and that is the General Morgan Inn. And as I was looking at it, I was like, well, there's not really enough information here for an entire show. Is there something else that is haunted in this same town? And wouldn't you know, Kelly, they have one of those old county jails here.
Love them.
So we're going to be doing the old Greene County Jail as well. Before we get into that, we want to welcome into the Spooktacular crew, Abby with just an I, and Jessica.
Thank you so much for joining the Spooktacular crew.
And now this moment in oddity.
On this episode, we are featuring a couple of locations in Appalachia, and while researching the area, we came across a creepy bit of folklore. There are these things called angel crowns or death crowns. These things are usually discovered by family members of a loved one who has recently passed away in their bed. A death crown is created inside of a feather pillow. It's usually noticed when a bereaved family member clutches the pillow and hugs it to themselves. They'll feel a weird clump or lump of feathers. When they open up the pillow, they find a crown of feathers tightly wound together. All the quills of the feathers point to the center of the crown. Appalachian folklore claims that these death crowns are signs that a deceased loved one has made it to heaven. The death crown symbolizes that a person has been absolved of their sins. So if you had a family member that perhaps was a little on the bad side, this would bring you comfort. Finding a death crown is a great omen, but only if it's found in this way. If, for example, you find a death crown in your pillow, it means you're not meant to have a long life. Or it could also be an evil omen that a witch has cast a curse on someone. The best way to deal with that is to cast the crown into the fire. Appalachian tradition holds that family members are to put the death crown on display, and most are stored in shadow boxes. Many families will share pictures with the local paper as well. Oftentimes, these are passed down through the family. This is an interesting tradition and bit of folklore, but it also certainly is odd.
Turn out the lights. The party's just getting started.
And now, this month in history.
In the month of January on the 24th in 1935, canned beer made its debut to the American public. The Gottfried Kruger Brewing Company made 2,000 cans of their finest beer and cream ale available to the public in Richmond, Virginia. The consumers gave an approval rating of 91%, motivating the brewery to continue their production. Cans had already been widely used for food items starting in the late 19th century. In 1909, the American Can Company experimented with canning beer, but they were unsuccessful. 2 years of research went into the development of a can that could contain the pressurized liquid with a special coating to keep the beer from chemically reacting with the tin. The major beer companies were not keen on marketing their brews in cans initially. However, after Kruger took the leap of faith, their sales soared with 80% of distributors carrying their product. The market blew up in 3 short months, and following Kruger's success, the big three, Anheuser-Busch, Pabst, and Schlitz, jumped into the game. By the completion of 1935, over 200 million cans of beer had been manufactured and sold.
Greenville is part of what is referred to as the Tri-Cities in Tennessee. This is a region that comprises the bigger cities of Kingsport, Johnson City, and Bristol, and smaller towns in Northeast Tennessee. This is part of Appalachia, a place known for its legends and spirits. Two locations here add to that reputation, the General Morgan Inn and the Old Greene County Jail. Join us as we share the history and hauntings of these two Tri-City locations.
Greenville, Tennessee was home to the 17th president of the United States, Andrew Johnson. I believe he's the first one who ever got impeached, too. This is a smaller town at the foot of the Appalachian Mountains and is the county seat for Greene County. Both the county and the town are spelled with an E at the end in honor of General Nathaniel Greene. He was one of the most respected generals of the Revolutionary War and was a great military strategist. Before settlers were here, there was a large indigenous village. This was during the Woodland period, which was dated from 1000 BC to 1000 AD. Eventually, the Cherokee used the area as their hunting grounds. Euro-Americans arrived in the late 18th century, and the first was Jacob Brown, who had moved from North Carolina. He leased a plot of land from the Cherokee, and he named it the Nolichucky Settlement. Another settler, Daniel Kennedy, decided to break free, and his group formed Greene County. This area was still a part of North Carolina. In 1784, several counties decided to break away and form their own state, which they planned to name Franklin. This group was called the Franklin Movement, and it eventually collapsed and North Carolina took back control in 1785. So we almost had a state of Franklin here in America. Greenville officially became a town in 1786, and Tennessee became a state in 1796. Many Quakers moved to Greene County, and so there was a strong abolitionist movement in the early 19th century. Andrew Johnson arrived in the city in 1826, and his home is now the Andrew Johnson National Historic Site. I looked up to see if it was haunted in any way, and I didn't find any ghosts there.
That's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. How can you have an old place and have it be a historic site and not have a ghost or two bopping around?
Taverns were the precursor or grandfather to the saloons that would spread across America into the Old West. These were social gathering places to hear music, to dance, to drink, and to find a simple room. Dunwoody Tavern was no different. This tavern was built by William Dunwoody in the early 1790s and offered a spot for travelers along the Great Wagon Trail, which is today parts of U.S. Highway 321 and State Highway 11.
What's interesting is that tavern was D-E-W-O-O-D-Y, and his last name started with D-U-N. I don't know why it was spelled differently than his actual name.
Maybe he thought it made it sound more fancy.
I guess. Dunwoody, Dewoody.
The Great Wagon Road stretched for 800 miles between Philadelphia and West Virginia and broke off into the Wilderness Road to arrive in Kentucky and Tennessee. The early stages of the trail could only be traversed by horseback because it was so narrow and rough. After the French and Indian War, it expanded as it became the most heavily traveled road in America. This would have been a beautiful path, as it is today, but one can only imagine trying to get through it with a Conestoga wagon packed full with supplies and possessions and a trail full of mud and animal waste. Taverns and inns offered a respite from that and a place to water animals.
The Dunwoody Tavern was a wooden structure described as janky.
Okay.
You're the only other person I've heard use that word before, so it was so funny when I was reading. I think that was specifically from their website for the inn.
Too funny.
And I was like, okay, it was a wooden janky building. It offered food, supplies, and lodging and had plenty of water because of Greenville's big spring. By the 1920s, the tavern was being called the Bell Tavern and was owned by William K. Vance and was advertised as a public house at the sign of the Bell in Greenville. During the Civil War, the inn was owned by Joshua Lane, and he called it the Lane House for himself. This establishment didn't choose sides during the war and served both Union soldiers and Confederates. And while being neutral during a war seems like a safe bet, it didn't work out for Greenville because the soldiers themselves can't be trusted to keep the peace. It'd be kind of like having the Crips and the Bloods in the same location and being like, hey guys, let's all just get along. It just never works out that way.
Sure.
One of Greenville's most infamous skirmishes occurred on September 4th, 1864.
There was a Confederate general named John Hunt Morgan, but everybody knew him by his nickname, the Thunderbolt of the Confederacy.
I can already hear Mia quaking at that name. She's always in the studio when we're recording, and she definitely does not like thunder.
I'm wondering, because we're supposed to get a little bit of weather today, and she is not settling down, walking all over our cords and everything.
Yeah, she usually kind of goes over into the corner and falls asleep, but she's like been underfoot, and yes, very pestering.
Morgan was from Kentucky and attended Transylvania College in Lexington until he was expelled for bad behavior. He turned to the military after that and enlisted with the 1st Kentucky Cavalry and joined the fight during the Mexican War. At the Battle of Buena Vista, he conducted himself gallantly and headed back to Kentucky in 1847. Morgan got into hemp manufacturing and formed a militia he dubbed the Lexington Rifles.
Sure, it was hemp.
I was like, wow.
I'm sure he was just making rope.
Manufactured hemp that far back. I did not realize.
I mean, hemp's been around for...
I know, but...
Probably something
I guess
that the Native Americans showed them.
I'm sure, but I just had not heard of that previously in terms of using that verbiage.
We need to go and look in history. We get the history of hemp. I have no idea when it all started. All right, so we're going to go ahead and go down that rabbit hole. Hello?
Hello?
We're down here in the rabbit hole.
And we've brought you with us.
This history of hemp is according to our agriculture department here in the United States. The first records of hemp cultivation and use are from China, where the species most likely originated. Migrating peoples likely brought hemp to Europe, where by the 16th century it was widely distributed, cultivated for fiber, and the seed cooked with barley or other grains and eaten. Hemp reportedly was first grown in the New World in Chile in 1545. The Puritans brought hemp to New England in 1645 as a fiber source for household spinning and weaving, but it never rivaled flax in importance. Cultivation spread to Virginia and in 1775 to Kentucky, where the crop grew so well a commercial cordage industry developed. The hemp industry flourished in Kentucky, Missouri, and Illinois between 1840 and 1860 because of strong demand for sailcloth and cordage by the U.S. Navy. However, increased production of cotton in the South due to the development of the cotton gin and imports of cheaper jute and abaca eventually displaced most domestic hemp production. In 1937, Congress passed the Marijuana Tax Act, which placed all cannabis culture under the regulatory control of the U.S. Treasury Department. Marijuana under the Treasury Department? The act required the registration and licensing of all hemp growers with the federal government in an effort to restrict production of marijuana in the United States. During World War II, it went up a little bit more, but that's kind of where it got started. So it didn't have anything to do with Native Americans like I put out there. I would have never guessed China to begin with. There's a hemp rope sitting right here, so we have a perfect way to get out of this hole.
He armed the entire militia at his own expense. Kentucky wasn't quick to join the cause of the Confederacy at the beginning of the Civil War, but Morgan was, and he led the Lexington Rifles to Bowling Green, where they fought under General Buckner. By the Battle of Shiloh in April 1862, Morgan had become a colonel. A couple months later, he began running raids all on his own with his cavalry, and in July 1862, Morgan began a 1,000-mile ride through Kentucky, acting like a thunderbolt, destroying everything in his path. Railroad and telegraph lines were destroyed, and they took Union soldiers as prisoners. They seized supplies, too. Newspaper headlines documented the raids, and people feared Morgan. So now you see how he came by his nickname.
Morgan continued under his own lead through the next year. His leadership ordered him to not conduct any more raids, but he rode along the Ohio River and terrorized southern Indiana and Ohio for 3 weeks until he was captured at West Point by the Union cavalry. Morgan was shipped off to the Ohio State Penitentiary, but he managed to escape. Morgan had a friend who lived in Greenville named Mrs. Catherine Williams, and she had invited him to stay at her mansion in the middle of the town. The property had quite a bit of vegetation and trees and a vineyard, so it provided a bit of secrecy. Despite this, some Union troops had been tipped off that Morgan was in town, and they surrounded the mansion in an ambush. The Williams family tried to help Morgan escape, but there was no hope. Morgan was shot and killed as he ran from the yard to the stables. The soldier who is said to have shot him had served under him during the Mexican War, so it was like one of his own men from before.
Wow.
The Union cheered the end of a man that had terrorized everyone.
The landscape changed for Greenville in 1886 when the East Tennessee and Virginia Railroad built a new train depot in the town. A local entrepreneur named Colonel John Doty decided the city needed a new hotel. So in 1884, he tore down the Lane House and built the Grand Central in its place. This was a four-story brick building with marble belts at each floor and window level. This was said to be the finest hotel from Chattanooga to Roanoke. The interior featured wide hallways and luxurious furniture and 60 rooms. The lobby featured a warm fireplace, 35-foot ceilings, a hand-painted canopy, and ornate chandeliers that have been recreated for the modern-era hotel. An upper balcony stretched across the front of the second story. There were several shops on the street level of the hotel, and a flight of stairs led out onto Main Street. Several spaces in the hotel were designated as sample rooms, where salesmen could ply their wares.
Grand Central Hotel not only rented rooms for a night, but people could rent them for a month. The hotel tells the story of Mr. and Mrs. Humphreys Reeves, who were newlyweds that married in December of 1892. They spent their first 6 months of marriage renting three rooms for $30 a month, and they got three meals a day as well.
Sounds like a deal to me.
Yeah. Apparently it wasn't, though. As the seventh month rolled around, Mrs. Reeves told her husband it was time to end their extravagant living, and they rented a house for $12 a month until they built one of their own. So I guess she was like, okay, we're living above our means.
That's intelligent.
Yeah, interesting. You'd think at the time that the wife would be like, hey, I don't mind being served the meals and not having to do all the work. Three other railroad hotels joined the Grand Central, and all four hotels were connected on their second floors with bridges. There was like an alleyway that was between each one.
Mrs. E.J. Brumley bought the Grand Central in 1920, and she reopened it as the Hotel Brumley. In 1925, William Jennings Bryan, who was a well-known orator and three-time presidential candidate, stopped at the hotel for lunch on his way to the Scopes trial in Dayton. In 1928, the Brumleys began an extensive remodeling of the hotel, adding the Crystal Ballroom on the second floor, where formal events such as balls, dinners, and wedding receptions were frequently held. Judd Brumley, who was a son, took over operating the hotel, and he opened the General Morgan Room in 1948. This was a supper club-style private dining room on the first floor of the hotel, where the elegant Crystal Ballroom had been. He purchased azure-etched mirrors for the space that hang in the Brumley's bar today.
I guess they're pretty fancy, so it's really cool that they were able to hold on to them and still have them today.
Nice. It was a hit and was soon known for being a prestigious location to hold an event. Mrs. Brumley died in 1964, and Judd followed her soon thereafter, and other family members took over operations. The Brumley family ran the hotel until it closed in May of 1981, and then sat vacant for several years.
A local development group formed a new board called Old Town Development Corporation, and their goal was to buy up historic buildings. The Hotel Brumley became one of their purchases, and after 9 years of planning, fundraising, and construction, they opened the General Morgan Inn and Conference Center in 1996, named for the Confederate general who came to his end in the town. A friendly foreclosure sale was held on November 29, 2000, and the hotel was sold to the Morgan Inn Corporation, which still runs it today. The General Morgan Inn was added to the National Trust Historic Hotels of America and the National Trust for Historic Preservation. It is a popular wedding venue today and has 51 guest rooms, a luxurious suite, and a corporate apartment. The inn also boasts the signature restaurant and lounge, Brumley's, which of course is a hat tip to its history. This space features the bar, the club room, the green room, and the library. And it's a favorite space for a ghost or two. And the interesting thing about that library is you walk in and you're like, oh, look, the shelves are full of books, except for that the shelves aren't very deep, so those aren't really books. It's just like a faux kind of wall decor.
Really?
It looks kind of cool, but you're like, oh, those aren't really books.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And now a little break for a word about one of our sponsors.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Many of the articles written about the General Morgan Inn claim that there are dozens of ghosts in the hotel, possibly as many as 40. One of the spirits is said to be General Morgan himself. Perhaps he was attracted to a place that had been named for him. We aren't sure how close the mansion was to the hotel, but he more than likely didn't die on this property. Although he did once tell a group that was investigating room 207 that he had been shot in the back and died on the premises. So perhaps he did die here. His favorite area to hang out is on the second floor, and he loves a suite since it's the finest room at the inn. General Morgan was a handsome man and was thought of to be quite vain. He wouldn't allow anyone to photograph him unless he had his general's hat on his head.
Which is funny, if you're vain, you think you'd want to show off your hair too, but...
No, he wanted that for his stature.
Yeah, that's true.
In the military, I'm sure. This vanity has led the general to be quite attached to his picture, which hangs in the suite. Guests have called the front desk claiming to hear screaming coming from the suite, even when nobody is staying in there. The staff usually says they'll take care of it, even though they know the room is empty. They're used to it by now.
One has to wonder, though, after you've made the call and then you hear some screaming later on, would you be like, did you guys take care of it or not? Because they just have a standard response that they give to everybody.
Sure.
And a lot of the time I heard it described as screaming, not just noises coming from the room, which I'm like, why is there screaming? Did he really die on the property, maybe? I don't know. Or is he it's another one of those questions we have about the paranormal. Can you maybe relive what you've been through, even though it's not exactly at that location? Around the turn of the 20th century, a waitress worked in the inn and her name was Grace. She was good at what she did and clearly liked the hotel enough to stay on in the afterlife. The staff affectionately refers to her as Green Room Grace. She is seen nearly daily, and even if not seen, she tends to do some kind of mischievous thing in the Brumley restaurant. Her favorite thing to do is to steal silverware, a particular piece of silverware. She has a fondness for spoons, and she usually takes those spoons out of the green room, which is where her nickname comes from. Grace is pretty possessive of the spoons as well, meaning that she never returns them. No one knows where she puts them.
Uh-oh, maybe under a floorboard somewhere?
I imagine they're going to peel back a wall one day and voila, a bunch of spoons are going to fall out.
Voila.
Beverly Merzen was a server at Brumley's restaurant for several years, and she told WJHL Channel 11 in 2019, "You'll walk through and you'll notice a spoon is missing, so we have to order spoons all the time. We're always out of spoons. It's crazy. Why spoons? I don't know. Where she puts them? I don't know." Beverly also confirmed that Grace likes to make the pictures in the restaurant go crooked. They constantly have to straighten them. A dowser came in to investigate the hotel and thought they were speaking with Grace, who said she had been haunting the building for 75 years, and that Grace claimed to have 9 ghosts with her. Beverly believes that she saw one of these spirits as a full-bodied apparition out of the corner of her eye while she was filling salt and pepper shakers. When she turned, she saw the outline of a body walk away. It was so quick she assumed it was one of the dishwashers. She went around the corner to see who it was, and there was nobody there. She said to herself, "It's time to go." I'd never seen a full-bodied apparition just go across the kitchen.
Of course, you and I would be like chasing after it going, can we talk to you, please?
Yeah. She's like, "I'm out of here."
And the kitchen is pretty active itself. Heavy objects move by themselves in the kitchen and occasionally go flying across the room. One time, huge cookie sheets went flying off the top of the oven and across the kitchen. That would be pretty terrifying because for those of you who've worked in a big kitchen, cookie sheets are not like your cookie sheets that you have at home.
No, they're heavy.
They're like twice the size, very heavy. If those go flying across the room, you're like, yikes.
Duck.
Another spirit in the restaurant is a man who sits at a booth in the club room and drinks coffee and reads the newspaper. That's exactly how they described it, and all I could think to myself is, are you imagining that he's doing that? Do you put out a coffee cup for him and a newspaper because he's indicated that he likes that to investigators or something? Does the coffee go down? Do the pages flip on the newspaper? How do you know?
I'm just wondering if it's residual. And so that's how he's seen previously.
Okay, so they look over and they see him looking like he's drinking coffee and reading a paper.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense to me than I'm like, well, how do you know that he likes to drink the coffee and read the paper? Do you see those things like movie? And the elevators are haunted, moving up and down on their own and opening on floors where they haven't been called. During an investigation near the front desk, a ghost named Bill was contacted. He claimed to be very happy working at the front desk, and he claimed to have 26 ghosts with him. He is now known as Front Desk Bill. And that was it. I didn't find any other kind of investigations that have been conducted here. None of the big TV shows have gone there. For a place that's claiming to have 40 ghosts, what is going on? Why are people not checking this place out?
Right.
We need more information.
Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, holy cow, everything, you know, it's one of those places that is supposed to be crazy haunted. And then there's 20 websites that all say the exact same information. And you can tell they watch the exact same news programs that I did with the interviews and just wrote out the same stuff. So I'm like, has anybody actually literally gone in there and done investigations and put that information up? Or people who've stayed there? If you've had a little something weird happen, make sure you put that in the reviews because we do read TripAdvisor.
Right. Another haunted location in this city is the Old Greene County Jail. The jail is the oldest jail in the state of Tennessee and is located at 115 Academy Street. But it didn't start at this location. The jail was built in 1804 in the middle of Depot Street, and it was very close to Richland Creek. So it was thought it would be better to move it to prevent flooding.
This was so close to the creek that I'd heard that the toilet just kind of emptied out in that direction.
Ugh. Better than a honeypot. So they had actual toilets? Or was it just for the
There was
sheriff?
A hole.
Oh, okay.
And you just shot it out the hole, and I guess it hit the creek below, and hopefully nobody was getting any water out of it downriver. Oh,
loverly. So moving the jail was done brick by brick in 1838. It has been in its current location for over 180 years. This location is behind the current day Greene County Jail and courthouse. The jail was a dark place, and prisoners would live in semi-darkness. Originally, there was only one floor, but a second was added in the late 1800s. The first floor had one cell and a place for prisoners to relieve themselves by sitting over a hole in the floor. And the second floor was more modern and had four cells where there was at least a platform for prisoners to sit on to do their duty. You said duty.
I know. And I did that on purpose.
There was no running water and no heat for a very long time until the second floor was upgraded. Some prisoners were executed. The last legal hanging took place in 1890. The jail ran until 1987. At Halloween time, the jail is turned into a haunted house attraction, but there are those who claim that there are real hauntings here.
This is a fairly small jail, but definitely seems to have some stuff going on. It's said that the local police refuse to enter this location after dark because it's so haunted. And yet, people who are tour guides there say, oh, we've never had any experiences at all.
Huh.
So I'm like, which is true? The tour guides who are always there not having any experiences? Or is it really that the police refuse to enter the location because it's so scary after dark? I have a feeling it's just more active in the evening when tour guides aren't there.
Probably.
Because these people definitely that went and investigated caught some stuff. Josh and John head up Southern Afterlife and they investigated the jail in 2021. They heard a humming sound coming from a corner cell, kind of like a ringing sound. So I was thinking maybe it was possibly something bouncing off the metal of a door. You know, if you like hit it, metal
it vibrates.
Has that ringing kind of thing. Uh-huh. And that's kind of how they were describing the sound as that kind of a reverberating ringing.
Strange.
Humming. So it wasn't like a human humming. It was more of a metallic type.
Vibration.
Yes. They set up a spirit box and it was really weird. The minute he turned that thing on, there was the sound of a baby crying. And then the very next thing was a very clear, no doubt about it, child voice asking, play?
Oh, wow.
So I'm sitting there thinking, this is a jail. It's been moved from the location it was at. So I'm wondering what was there before the jail was moved to this location.
Or could it have been, were there rooms for a jailer's family?
No, this was not set up like one of our county jails that I'm aware of. I don't know for sure.
Okay.
But I don't think that the jailer lived there. Now, maybe that is
maybe
the case.
Next door.
And that could be why we would have children here. Because I was just like, whoa, I was not expecting the first two things to come through being children.
Right.
Then it said, this is Pat's block. A female voice answered that her name was Marissa after being asked. So he said, do we have a name? There was Marissa came through.
What's your name?
The name Thomas came through and they asked if this was Thomas and it said, yep. And then later on it said, Thomas here. So there definitely seems to be some kind of a spirit named Thomas there.
Is your name Thomas? Yep.
Multiple voices came through and said, help us leave.
Oh, wow.
Help us leave.
There was a scream, and then a voice said, quit screaming.
Oh, wow. Goodness gracious.
So kind of like when we say spirits sound like they're talking to each other, it's almost like they were
talking
to each other. Or maybe it's reenacting something that happened in the past. Somebody was getting hit, screaming about it, and the person's telling them to quit screaming about it.
They were told multiple times to leave and get out. They weren't sure if it was a request for them to leave or if they were being asked to help the spirits leave. A cell door slammed on its own. It was pretty startling.
Yeah, I even jumped because I was not expecting it, and it was like a big bang.
They tested the door to see if it would slam on its own, but they couldn't find any way that it would do that. They heard disembodied steps coming down the hallway. They also caught a couple of little figures on the SLS camera.
Again, I would say they were children
because
they were about half the size of the cell door.
So were these kids again? Another group of paranormal investigators were in there in 2021 as well. They were told to get out. They said they would leave the cell if they were told a name, and they got the name Peter. And they caught a few strange sounds.
Yeah, and this was like a group of three separate paranormal investigation groups that were all doing it together. So I would say there's definitely a little something going on there.
Sounds that way.
There's also a bridge that is reputedly haunted in Greenville called Little Chucky Creek Stone Arch.
Huh.
It's a stone bridge and it's lasted many years. And despite the fact that everywhere I looked, its nickname really is the Little Chucky Creek Stone Arch Haunted or Haunted Little Chucky Creek Stone Arch, I couldn't find any stories on it. So I'm like,
wow. Okay.
I guess you could just label it that, but there wasn't even like a legend to go with it. I'm like, at least a crybaby bridge has a legend to go with it.
Right.
So I don't know why they claim it's haunted. It's a very cool bridge, though. Lots of people go there to photograph it. So it'd be a cool place to check out just for that. And I'm sure it's called Little Chucky because the name of the river is Nolly Chucky. But the jail and inn seem to have something unexplained going on. Are they haunted? That is for you to decide. Another area in Tennessee to check out. And it's really close to North Carolina because it basically was almost part of North Carolina for a long time there. We'd love to have you guys check out our website at historygoesbump.com. And if you'd like to send us some feedback, you can do that at historygoesbump@gmail.com. Some other feedback, I guess we could put it that way, that we would love to get from you guys is, how are you loving those paranormal conversations? And how would you like to be part of one of those?
Yeah.
We want to get more into listener stories. We know a ton of other podcasts do them, and it seems to be very popular with people. We read a lot of your stories on here. We love that you share those with us. Continue to do that. But if you would like to actually come on and chat with us, share your experiences. Maybe you've investigated some places, want to share what happened at those places to you, want to share some of your thoughts on what you think a ghost is. We could have all kinds of paranormal celebrities on here, but they've been done to death. We want something different and new, and that's what you guys are. So if you are a listener and you'd love to join us, just email us at historygoesbump@gmail.com and we'll get you all set up.
Yep. Shoot us a message. And for clarification, you do not have to be on camera if you do not wish to.
No, You can just hide behind a screen. Yes, we don't have to have your pretty little faces out there. Although we love seeing you. Also, if you'd like to become a more integral part of History Goes Bump, please consider becoming a patron in 2024 here. You can just head over to patreon.com/historygoesbump, sign up. There are literally hundreds of bonus episodes over there for you to enjoy. And even without all of that, it really does help us keep the show going.
Yes, we could certainly use the support.
We want to thank you guys for tuning in to this episode. I've been your host, Diane.
And this has been Kelly.
You take care now.
Bye-bye.
This episode is brought to you by our executive producers.
Dispatches from the Grave Digger.
We want to welcome into the cemetery, Jessica Feeney. You are going to be buried in a chest tomb. And Stephen St. Amour. You're going to be put in a garden crypt, meaning in 3 months, you'll be getting your HGB logo mug. And then after a year, you'll get your choice of t-shirt.
Thank you so much for supporting the show.
Thanks for tuning in, Spookies.
Canned beer made its debut to the American public. Thank you to whoever did that.
And yesterday, being the 24th, was Canned Beer Appreciation Day.
Oh, well, we're recording this in the past, so I foresee in the future we will be appreciating some beers on that day.
I do as well.
It's kind of like having gangs all in the same place. You
sure.
Got your blues and your bloods or whatever, and you're expecting them all to
the
just
blues
stay.
And the bloods. The crypts. You can repeat that. We'll put that one in the bloopers.
I'm so hip on my games.
The blues and the bloods.
I was thinking about what they wear. I did
live in California for 45 years of my life, so I heard enough about them.
You would know better than I, yes.
Close to LA. So. Railwood?
Railwood.
Railwood.
You can go down on some railwood, I'm sure. What are you just riding the
wood along the rails?
Railroad ties. Those are made out of wood, right?
Yes. This was said to be the finest hotel from Let's go to Chattanooga.
Chattanooga, choo-choo. A friendly floor
closure.
Floor closure. See, I didn't know.
It's a friendly floor closure.
They could do a floor closure on all kinds of things. It's like, if you're just closing down the floor, do I really have to give you over the house or the building? And I always love it when they call it a friendly foreclosure.
Sure it was.
They come over and say, hey, how you doing? I'm going to close the place down on you. Let's go to
court.
Get
the heck out.